You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa. Today we are in Terme Vigianem.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, non spigudeci cora. Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney, and I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Lionel. You survived the shark-infested waters.
We did indeed, yes. Just about. I think it was a close thing, though, wasn't it? I saw a silhouette of something in the sea last night.
You've had another nervous day, haven't you?
Always.
You really have.
Always.
Where are we?
Where are we? We are at Terme Luigiane, which is a spa town, isn't it?
It's the most salutary, is that a word in English? It's a word in Italian. The healthiest, the best spa waters in Europe, I've just been told by the hotel waiter. We're in a hotel, aren't we?
We are. Well, actually, we're at the BMC Racing Team Hotel. There's a smell of sulfur in the air. It sort of comes and goes,
doesn't it? A stink, not a smell.
A stink, yeah. It's sort of boiled eggs, isn't it? And I know, Daniel, you're not a fan of boiled eggs or eggs of any kind.
I don't trust people that eat eggs, do I?
Bizarre.
That's a true story.
Bizarre. Eggs are fine. Yeah, BMC Racing. All the riders are in the hotel now. The truck is in the background, so you might hear the... Well, that's a motorbike. That's not the BMC truck. And they've had a very good day here on the Giro. It was stage 6 from Reggio Calabria to Terme Luigiana. 217 kilometres, so the longest stage of the race so far. And we were remarking as we drove the last 70 kilometres, weren't we, Daniel, that the course was sort of reminiscent of a southern Milan-San Remo type route. It hugged the coastline and then it dove inland just to go over a couple of small climbs. It was reasonably significant climbs, actually. And then there was the drag up to the finish. The race was shaped by a break of 5 riders. Lucas Perstelberger, the first Maglia Rosa of the race, the Bora rider, he was in it. Mads Pedersen and Jasper Stuyven of Trek were in there. Simone Andrita of Bardiani and Sylvain Dillier of BMC. They had about 8 minutes at one point. It was coming down. Cannondale did an awful lot of chasing all afternoon, really. Into the last 10 kilometres, though, with 2 minutes 39 still in hand, it was obvious that the survivors of the break were going to fight out the stage. And on the final climb, Perstelberger cracked and it was left to a shootout between the men in red and black, Dillier and Stuyven. And it was a close finish. And Dillier got it, the Swiss rider. A very appropriate victory because apparently he was born in Baden by Zurich, which is another spa town. So he will have felt right at home here with the smell of rotten eggs, I assume. Although I don't know if Baden smells, has a similar aroma in the air. I don't know.
Baden, I think, definitely does in Germany. Or maybe not. Well, it certainly has the spa bars. Dillier, I expected him to have a big breakthrough year last year. I thought that he would make a big splash in 2016. Didn't quite happen for him. He had one crash at the Giro, didn't he?
He did, yeah. He didn't even make it to Italy. He crashed on the third of the 3 stages in the Netherlands, broke his finger pretty badly, wasn't able to finish the stage, and that was the end of his Giro, yeah.
Yeah, but he's a very talented rider and a quick rider as well. I mean, looking at that group and knowing the form that Stuyven has been in and his pedigree as a sprinter, really, a small group sprinter or even a bunch sprinter, you would have thought that he would win quite comfortably. So it's a real feather in Dillier's cap to beat Stuyven.
Yeah, Dillier did say that he was frightened of Stuyven because of the Belgian's reputation as a sprinter. But perhaps, easy to be wise after the fact, but not necessarily the sort of finish that Stuyven would excel at. Quite steep in places, that finish, a 1.5-kilometre drag up to the line. If it had been a bit flatter, the odds would have swung back towards Stuyven, I think. But Dillier, he said he felt strong all day, and he felt particularly strong at the finish, and he felt like he had just about enough, and that's how it turned out. But isn't it funny, BMC Racing, last year they came to the Giro, and they didn't have they didn't have a sprinter, they didn't have a GC rider, they didn't really have anyone getting in many breaks. I mean, they just rode their way around Italy. This year they come with 2 GC riders. Rowan Dennis has gone home. TJ Van Garderen is still here and still well-placed along with all the other GC riders. But you know, despite having all of that focus on a overall classification bid, they still managed to pull out a stage win. I was quite surprised by that.
Yeah, and I think it's a team that's very slowly shed its image of the sort of misfiring rich boys of the peloton. Certainly when they first made a big investment in European cycling, they had a lot of guys on a lot of money. Torhoshov, they had Philippe Gilbert, George Hincapie, and so forth and so forth. And they had the big success with Cadel Evans in the Tour de France in 2011. But certainly one day races, they were, well, they didn't really perform to the level you would have expected. But I think since the old HTC Colombia Direct Sportifs have come on board, Alan Piper and Valeria Piva, there's been a slow metamorphosis of that team. And but it's taken a few years for it to kick in. It's taken 3 or 4 years, and you've got other guys like Marco Pinotti there who is a sort of technical consultant coach as well. And it really has changed, I think, the culture there, and they are winners now, or they've certainly got a reasonable number of winners. There are still, I think, issues, and they've still had their problems in the last couple of years with TJ Van Garderen, for example, in Grand Tours. And but, you know, things have looked up for them, generally speaking.
Yeah, I didn't mention at the start that the overall picture hasn't really changed at all. Bob Jungels of Quickstep is still in pink. Geraint Thomas and Adam Yates stacking up behind him at 6 and 10 seconds, respectively. We'll hear from both those riders, in fact, a little bit later in the podcast. And there's this whole group of riders on at 10 seconds behind Jungels. We were wondering whether there might be a little bit of movement on the final climb, but there wasn't really, was there? It wasn't hard enough for those guys to come out to play, I guess.
No, you feel it would have been different if they had been sprinting for the stage win and there'd been bonus seconds available. As it was purely a stage for the opportunists and the teams that are here really looking for stage wins. One of those teams, of course, is Cannondale. And Lionel, you're going to have to mention the significance of tomorrow's date, because I've done it on a couple of occasions already, and I don't want to get in trouble again.
Well, I mean, it's a two-year anniversary. It's going to be known as Davide Formolo Day, I think, because it was 2 years ago tomorrow that Cannondale last won a World Tour race, and it's not so much a drought now as a kind of a long, long, lonely trek into the desert for them, isn't it? But give them their due, and also just to sort of go back on something we talked about in the podcast last night about the big teams not putting riders in breaks. Fair play to Trek for getting two men in there. BMC, of course. Border with Pöstl Berger, who's already had a stage win and a day in pink on the Giro. Just while I mention Pöstl Berger, if you're interested in finding out a bit more about the Austrian rider, Richard's Kilometre Zero episode went up yesterday. Very good it is indeed. It features his mum. A really nice listen just to find out a little bit more about one of the riders who shaped the opening days of the race. But you mentioned Cannondale, Daniel, and fair play to them. What they did, give it their all. They were very prominent, but arguably they left it too late to bring it back together. We think they were working for both Tom Jelte Slagter and Michael Woods. Obviously Woods, because he followed through and then went for the sprint finish and got fourth on the stage, almost obligated to do so after his teammates had done so much work. But they left it too late. They just got it wrong, didn't they?
Yeah, they were obviously disappointed tonight. I was at the team bus, so the Cannondale Drapac team bus, the finish, and spoke to Fabrizio Guidi, the director sportif. You'll hear his voice first, and then Joe Dombrowski.
Mike Woods, Slagter, Pierre, Formolo, they didn't work. The goal was today for us to bet on the sprint. This is a final appeal. We had Tom and Mike. It could have been good today, and we played for this, but we knew that we were also finding an interest of other team. And I was thinking that with only five guys, but four teams in front, someone maybe would have taken also the lead together with us. But the four guys in front were super strong, so chapeau and complimenti, because that's cycling and they deserve. And for us, we got five. So that was, I think, a good choice, but we didn't catch them, so.
I think we just started pulling too late, to be honest, because They had 9 minutes when we started to pull, and it was a strong group ahead, and yeah, I just don't think we're going to bring that back. So, yeah, pretty draining day on the front.
Hot and humid as well, and smelly. Very, yeah, very smelly.
What is that smell here?
Well, it's, these are spa baths.
It's quite sulfuric.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So, Lionel, was there a bit of dissension in the camp?
Well, as football supporters, you know, do you disagree publicly with the coach? I don't know. I mean, it's not the done thing in football, is it? I mean,
it was very mild, though. I think... I think Dombrowski was right. They did start too late, but then on the other hand, they also didn't really get very much help at all.
Well, I don't think they got any help really, did they?
No, and again, it's this issue we've talked about a couple of times now, that so many teams are here with big goals, big objectives, big ambitions, and they're simply not interested in stages like this.
But if the boss says publicly that they got it right and it just didn't come off, then they, you know, fair play to the riders. I mean, you certainly can't say they didn't give it everything when they were on the front, because they were all putting their shoulder to the wheel, so to speak.
I did see the Giro director Mara Venu looking a bit hot and bothered at the finish. I don't know whether that was because he would have liked the general classification riders or their teams to show a bit more interest, or it could simply have been because he'd missed the buffet, because he had it gone when he arrived.
Well, I missed the buffet as well, just to I've smashed my phone. I mean, it's just been one of those days.
We've talking about the calamaries of the Mafia. Yeah.
No, we haven't. The Mafia, oh my goodness. I've only just got over the threat of the shark. Maybe Mara Venu was just nervous that Christian Prudhomme's been on the race today, the Tour de France director, his kind of opposite number in France. Maybe Prudy's listened to the cycling podcast Italiano, in which Mara Venu called the early stages of the Tour boring. I mean, there could be a little bit of friction there, maybe.
Could be focaccia at dawn.
Hey, it's Alexis Ryan, rider from Canyon SRAM, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. What I like about Rafa is their attention to detail and quality, producing the best clothing on the market. My most memorable ride was my first ride back after breaking my arm in 2014, and I can't ever remember being so excited to get on the bike.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits, and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsors, Rafa. Their support is enabling us to cover all three Grand Tours this year, as well as many other races on the calendar. You heard there Alexis Ryan, who is starting in the Amgen Women's Tour of California, I believe tonight, our time. But she is recording a rider diary for a future episode of the Cycling Podcast Feminin. So listen out for that. I assume that will be out towards the end of the month. While mentioning Rafa, we should also kick off the inaugural Pedaleur de Charme public vote. So I feel there ought to be a drum roll in here, because after much deliberation, the jury has selected the following four riders from all of your nominations. So one of these four will be the first Pedaleur de Charme of the Giro 100. Will it be Jasper Stuyven, or Matteo Pellucci, who had that terrible crash on the Etna stage, or Lucas Pöstlberger, who wore the first pink jersey of the race after winning the opening stage, or Luca Pibernik, who had the misfortune of thinking he'd won, only to find out he'd celebrated too early? You can vote for your favourite on Twitter. It's the pinned tweet on the Cycling Podcast Twitter page. That's @cycling_podcast. And you've got around 20 hours to add your vote. It closes on Friday evening. And the one with the most votes will win one of the very nice new Rafa Pedaleur de Charme t-shirts. A really smart design featuring a comb, featuring a bottle of eau de cologne, and a new logo. We'll post a picture of the new t-shirt as well, and we'll present the t-shirt at some point over the weekend to the winner. Daniel, back to the stage then. Was there anything else that caught your eye?
I want to talk about our journey.
Oh, okay.
Because I insisted that we stop in Rosarno, or very close between Rosarno and Gioia Tauro. And I've been giving you a bit of an education over the last few days about the Calabrese Mafia, the 'Ndrangheta, more menacing, more successful, if you want to call it success, than the Sicilian Mafia nowadays. And that is really the heart of the 'Ndrangheta where we were today in Rosarno, home of the Pesce clan, the 'Ndrina, and the Mbeloko 'Ndrina. It's no country for old men.
Well, I was perfectly willing to stop because I thought you had in mind a coffee or a slice of pizza or an ice cream. But when you told me that it was basically the heartland of the Calabrese mafia, I had second thoughts, not least because we're driving a rather eye-catching car, aren't we? Thanks to Maserati, we're in a Quattroporte. It's gleaming white, quite a lot of flies have landed on it today as we've driven along the course.
In fact, I was outside the press room about half an hour ago and Ivan Basso stopped me, he accosted me and said, "Daniel, I saw you the other day in a really nice car." So he sounded astonished, as though he expected to see me in a Lada.
Well, yes. I feel slightly incongruous driving such a nice car, but it's a pleasure to drive, and it's the way we are travelling around at the Giro. More on Maserati a little bit later on. But Daniel, anything else from the actual Giro d'Italia stage today?
No, not really. No, I was just thinking that I'd missed another opportunity to mention Steve Morabito and his mafia links. No, today's stage. When you're speaking to direct sportifs riders at the moment, the last couple of days, you keep hearing the same sort of phrases, the same descriptions of what's going on in the race at the moment. It's cat and mouse, it's poker, it's, you know, everyone's watching each other. Quintana is very cagey. Quintana is always a slightly kind of mysterious figure, this enigmatic figure, and today I noticed that he refused to or didn't want to go on Rai television. They invited him on and he sort of brushed them away. And, you know, Quintana comes into these races with an air of mystery always surrounding him. He's not raced much recently, he was riding in Asturias and won a stage there, but prior to that he was in Colombia, and, you know, again, a certain air of, or a certain mystique surrounds exactly how he trains in Colombia. I was talking to one of his old coaches the other day who talked about these races that he does, these, I think he calls them chequeos, like checkups, where he will invite local amateurs, local pros, for these impromptu races around Boyacá, and these are a fairly regular thing, and they'll do three laps of a circuit around the town, and then they'll do a summit finish. And apparently these races are absolutely extremely hard fought, and jumpers for goalposts, not exactly. It's it's pretty intense racing, I'm led to believe. And this is one of the reasons why he comes, apparently, this is one of the reasons why he comes back to Europe in such good form.
You've got to figure he wins most of those races, surely. I mean,
one would hope so.
Two other riders who are well up there in the GC. Geraint Thomas really is the only person who has an outside shot of winning the Giro who's gained anything on anybody else. Bob Jungels aside, of course, because he got that time bonus at Etna, Geraint Thomas did, and he is second overall. And Adam Yates is third and is currently wearing the white jersey, albeit on loan from Jungels. And Daniel, you had a quick word with both of them at the finish line tonight.
I did, Lionel.
Yeah, I felt pretty good. Just getting through, though, you know. So it's always a bit weird. Like today and yesterday, just, you're not completely switched on, but, you know, like a big GC day. But, legs seem to be okay.
Fairly happy with that outcome, Geraint, a break going clear.
Yeah, obviously it would have meant, would have been a bit less stressful. Although it was still pretty stressful because, you know, there might have been splits and things, so everyone wanted to be at the front and super on it, but all good.
Still feeling good?
Yeah, not bad.
Not disappointed, really. Just with a finish like this, it's always a bit of a gamble whether the sprinters can get up there or, you know, his climbers or punchy riders, but I was feeling pretty good at the end there. The break stayed away, so it is what it is.
And it wasn't a day when it was worth the team controlling the race for the, you know, for 10 bonus seconds.
I mean, the stage is what, 220 odd K, so if you're working all that day for a gamble, you're just wasting, you know, bullets there. And at the end of the day, it might not even come off. So I think, well, a lot of teams, nobody wanted to chase. I think there's only really Cannondale that were keen on chasing. And in the end, actually, I think it was Mike Woods that, he was first over the line from our group, so if he did come back, they would have pulled it off, but it's just one of them days.
Yeah, so Lionel, both of those guys pretty happy with the way things went. There's another similar stage in 2 days' time, finishing at Peschici. I think we mentioned that yesterday. Danilo Di Luca won there before. Franco Pellizzotti, I think, has won there. So it's a steep, it's a short, sharp, uphill finish. Again, could be an opportunity for the general classification riders to come to the fore, but on the evidence of today, I'm not so sure about that. And I think Cannondale will be really trying to rip it again. I think they're very, very confident in Michael Woods. Was speaking to, well, as you heard, was speaking to Fabrizio Guidi earlier on today, and he was also talking about Woods and how his numbers in lab tests and so forth are just phenomenal. Of course, he's someone who's come to professional cycling pretty late, a Canadian who used to be a competitive runner and has found cycling quite late in life, and this is his first Grand Tour, and he could be one of the stars, certainly of the first half of the race, before we get into the really high mountains.
You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia, supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. All of our listeners can get 20% off Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com by entering the code CPOD20. That's CPOD20, the number 20. That offer doesn't work in conjunction with any other offers, but you can get 20% off anything in your shopping basket. Daniel, we're moving away from the south of Italy. Maybe, you know, I'll start to feel less nervous, perhaps. I don't know. Reggio Calabria last night was not the prettiest of towns, I have to say. I was struck by how many unfinished buildings there are, not just there, but also as we drove up the coast to here. It's like a place that's been... they've been trying to redevelop, but everything just stalls and nothing gets completed.
Yeah, and you can see the lack of investment everywhere. The southern question, it's a huge issue in Italy, has been for, well, really since Italy was united in the 1860s and continues to be to this day. And there's a huge economic divide between the south and the north. Lots of unfinished buildings, Lionel. Not many unfinished dinners around our table last night.
Well, I mean, I was going to say the two oases of delight were our B&B, which was charming and lovely and completely unexpected, just tucked away in a little side alley, and the restaurant they recommended, from the top of my head, Officina del Gusto. And the meal was quite spectacular, wasn't it? And
very reasonable. Give us a couple of highlights quickly.
The couple of highlights were, I really enjoyed the chickpea soup that they brought along to start. Then we had an array of antipasti, and I particularly enjoyed, I mean, I thought the cheese was very good. I also enjoyed the aubergine mousse with some kind of sauce on the top. That was very nice. And then I had a piece of very nicely cooked tuna crusted in pistachios. And you had...
we've had quite a lot of pistachio nuts, haven't we, in the last couple of days. And bergamot. That's a bit of a revelation. It's a citrus fruit, isn't it?
Mm.
Very typical in the south of Italy and Sicily. And, yeah...
They rounded off our meal for us with a free glass, didn't they? Which was
bergamot liqueur.
Yeah, which they make on the premises. They said it was stunning. Very, very nice indeed. Reggio Calabria is also a town that the Sky sports director Brett Lancaster, an Aussie with a track background, he remembers that town very fondly because in 2005, when he was riding for the Panaria team, he won quite an unusual prologue time trial. It was held in the evening. It was very short, and he was upstaged by one of Italian cycling's great characters. I spoke to Brett Lancaster a few days ago about his memories of that day in Reggio Calabria.
Hi, I'm Brett Lancaster, sports director at Team Sky. It's my second year in the team, and loving every minute.
Now, the race goes to Reggio Calabria, which has special significance for you. Tell me the story of your racing experience there.
Yeah, it was a quite unique, let's say unique, 1.16, whatever it was, kilometre straight line drag race time trial. Myself sort of coming from off the track the year before, won the Olympic gold medal in Athens on the team's pursuit, and sort of put my track skills, if you could say that, into play. And I took that out and put the Maglia Rosa on and got to wear it for one day, only one day, but that was the memories. And I was in a small Italian team then, and it was the first time that they'd had the pink jersey for been in existence for 22 years, that team. So it was really big for them, and And of course, the public down there were incredible. They're really passionate about cycling, and it was a nice day the next day to wear that Maglia Rosa. It was probably one of the last in the team, second last from our team, actually. A guy called Padre de Grillo, I don't know if you remember him as a sprinter, he was last off for our team, but yeah, there are definitely some great memories, and it's time's flowing. It seems years ago now, but it'll be nice to get back there in a few days' time. And I'll go back to say, from the track experience, I did ride, you know, kilometre time trials, of course, when I was younger and national champion, etc. But I just paced it out. I was watching a lot of the other guys, a lot of the other sprinters, and with no sort of experience over that distance, they were going out very fast and blowing up at the end. So probably the last couple hundred metres were my quickest. So I really, you know, brought it home and kept the cadence high. I was training myself back then and did a lot of home trainer work before then. 2 minute efforts, you know, nothing, no rocket science, but yeah, just work on that brutal that power, and it all worked out on the day.
And so when you came over the line and realised you had the fastest time, then there's a nervous wait. Can you remember if there was anyone coming after you that you were worried about?
Yeah, of course. It was Tozzato actually came really close. I think he was second that day. And Pataki, third maybe. Yeah, they were really, really close. But of course, with a distance of 1-point-something kilometres, you're gonna have fractions, very small margins for the win. So yeah, it was nail-biting, but I really couldn't believe it when it happened, and yeah, it was one of the most memorable days of my whole life.
I don't want to take anything away from it, but you got upstaged a little bit as well on the night.
Yeah. That big bloody bugger. Yeah, Mario Cipollini, sort of, I guess you could call it his retirement little show, and yeah, that's fair enough, but it was still, he did steal my thunder a bit when he got up there, and he's trendy looking pink, you know, it's Cipollini, and I'm the young kid from country Victoria in Australia standing up there. But you know, I think that the crowd loved it, and you know, I was up there with Cipollini. The next day did finish up about a 2 kilometre climb. I was in, it come off a highway and really sketchy sort of finish, and I come into one of the corners, and I remember Damiano Cunico chopped the guts out of me, and had to pull my foot out. I was in a good position. I don't know if I could have held onto the lead, but I was motivated to do it. But then the dreams of holding it for another day were gone like that in a microsecond.
Well, Daniel, the smell of eggs is it's not making me hungry, that's for sure. Although I'm sure as soon as we get away from here, I will start to feel quite peckish. But before we go, I need you to just drop me off somewhere. There's somebody I need to go and see.
Okay, Lionel.
Daniel, would you mind just dropping me off on the corner here? There's somebody...
What, in front of Burger King?
No, there's no Burger Kings in southern Italy.
That's where you asked me to drop me yesterday.
This is absolute fake news. No, I just want to go and see somebody. I'll see you in a few minutes. So I'm going to go and find Sean Kelly, a man who won the Vuelta a España in 1988 and finished fourth overall in the Tour de France. I want to know why he didn't ride the Giro until right towards the end of his career. Sean Kelly, just a man, how are you?
Very good, enjoying Giro.
The weather's lovely, isn't it? The racing lukewarm at the moment?
Well, the weather has been perfect for racing. I think we needed that sort of weather because... starting in Sardinia, Sicilia, if we had bad weather, if you had wet roads, it would be carnage.
Now, Sean, you won the Vuelta a España in 1988. You finished fourth in the Tour de France in 1985, I think. But you didn't ride the Giro until your final year as a professional in 1992. Why was that?
Well, I was racing for a French-Spanish sponsor team. It became a full Spanish team with CAS later, but they were co-sponsors at the beginning, so I had an obligation to go to the races in Spain, notably the early season races, of course, like, you know, the Pays Basque and Andalusia, Tour de Valencia, and of course the Vuelta, the Tour of Spain, which was in the beginning of the season. It was immediately after the Classics. So having to do the Vuelta and with the Giro starting roughly about 2 weeks later, it was pretty much impossible to do. Although Jean de Garibaldi, my director sportif, tried it on more than one occasion. He said, yeah, blah, to ride the three big tours, it's not a problem. Physically he can do it, but mentally, if you listen to the journalists too much, they will make you tired mentally.
I mean, that would have been 9 weeks or thereabouts of racing in probably only about 14 weeks. A very heavy schedule that would have been in those days when the Vuelta started in mid-April, the Giro started in mid-May, and then the Tour starting at the end of June, as it was then. But people did do it, didn't they? Marino Lajarreta in your era rode all three a number of times.
Yes, Lajarreta was the more notable one, because he did some good results in some of them, if not all of them, I suppose you could say. You know, he might have been in the first 10 or first 15 in the general classification, all three. There was a teammate of mine, Philippe Poissonnier, who also did it on one occasion, but there has been a few. But, you know, if you do... the Vuelta, you know, back in the 80s, as it was the first three-week tour of the season, and then you go to Giro, where they're pretty much bianqui for the Tour de France.
Yeah, well done for the Tour de France before you even get there. You mentioned Di Grubaldi. He did try and strong-arm you into doing all three once by announcing to the press that King Kelly was going to ride all three Grand Tours, and you had to negotiate your way out of that by being a little bit clever, didn't you?
Well, he had been negotiating for the years previous, and every time I pulled a sickie, finished the Vuelta quite well, but then suddenly I was getting a little bit of a sore knee, and as I finished the Vuelta, or, you know, 24 hours later, it seemed to get very sore all of a sudden. And then he decided to try another tactic, of course. He announced that I was riding Giro, and he thought that would, you know, make me go there, because once the announcement was made, he felt that I didn't want to leave the organisation down, and of course the team. But I still pulled the same sickie every year.
But finally, in 92, you did ride the Giro, and that was for a commercial reason, wasn't it? Because Festina was the sponsor, and they had a big interest in Italy, the watchmaker. Was that really why it came about?
Yes, it was. Festina had big interests here, and Festina Italy, they wanted to have the team in, of course. And if I did not take the start, they would not have taken the team. So there was no choice there. And the agreement was that it would go for, you know, 5 or 6 days, but it ended up, I think, being 10 or 11 days, because to get out was always a problem. They were saying, well, just go another day, and it kept going on. And eventually, I got away, and I didn't have a good Giro. I wasn't motivated, and I didn't feel I wanted to be there. And that sort of circumstances, well, then you're not going to perform it.
Very lastly, what do you think of our car?
Very impressive. You better be careful where you park it, because here you could be renting a car one of these days.
Oh dear, I'm already nervous enough, Sean. You've not calmed my nerves at all. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Daniel, Sean says hello. I think we can go to our hotel now, and hopefully there's another fantastic dinner lined up for us.
Okay, Nigel, let's go.
The Cycling Podcast, on the road at the Giro d'Italia with Maserati. Visit maserati.co.uk to find out more about the new Levante, the Maserati of SUVs. Yours from £56,250 on the road.
A reminder that you can watch the Giro d'Italia live and exclusive on Eurosport and Eurosport Player. UK viewers can also watch highlights of each stage at 10 p.m. on free-to-air channel Quest. There's a special offer for the Eurosport Player, £29.99 for an all-access pass for the rest of 2017. Details of availability, compatible devices and full terms and conditions can be found on the Eurosport Player website, uk.eurosportplayer.com. You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA. Thanks to them, and thanks to our other sponsors, Science and Sport and Maserati, and to All Press Espresso for supporting our morning show, Kilometre Zero. The music in this episode is by Amara Terra. Thanks to them. Thanks to those who helped keep us on the road, in particular David Luxon, Jonathan Rowe, Nick Christian and Simon Gill. And thanks to Adam Bowie, who produced this episode.